Simon was in the midst of asking Maria a question when Binnebik raised his hand. As they rounded a bend, it was before them, a forest of impossibly graceful towers, set like a jeweled puzzle within the larger forest of trees. The Scythi city, flanking the river on either side, seemed to grow out of the very soil. It seemed the forest's own dream realized in subtle stone. 100 shades of green and white and pale summer sky blue. It was an immense thicket of needle-thin stone, of gossamer walkways like bridges of spiderweb, of filigreed tower tops and minarets reaching up into the high treetops to catch sun on their faces like icy flowers. The world's past lay open before them. Breathtaking and heartrending, it was the most beautiful thing Simon had ever seen. But as they floated into the city, the river winding around the slender columns, it became apparent that the forest was reclaiming Dai Chikiza. The tiled towers, intricate with cracks, were netted in ivy and the twining branches of trees. In many places, where once there had been walls and doors of wood or some other perishable substance, the stone outlines now stood precariously unsupported, like the bleached skeletons of incredible sea creatures. Everywhere, the vegetation was thrusting in, clinging to the delicate walls, smothering the whisper-thin spires in uncaring leaves. In a way, Simon decided, it only made it more beautiful, as though the forest, restless and unfulfilled, had grown a city from out of itself. Minnevik's quiet voice broke the silence, solemn as the moment. The echoes quickly vanished in the choking greenery.
Tree of the Singing Wind, they named it Dai Chikiza. Once, can you imagine, it was full of music and life. All the windows burned with lamps, and there were bright boats that sail upon the river.
The troll tilted his head back to stare as they passed beneath a last stone bridge, narrow as a feather quill, clothed in images of graceful antlered deer.
Tree of the Singing Wind, he repeated,
distant as a man lost in memory. Simon wordlessly steered their little craft over to a bank of stone steps that ended in a platform, nearly flush with the surface of the wide river. They climbed out, tying the boat to a root that had pushed through the cracked white stone. When they had mounted up, they stopped, staring silently at the vine-draped walls and mossy corridors. The very air of the ruined city was charged with quiet resonance, like a tuned but unplucked string. Even Kantaka stood seemingly abashed, tail held low as she sniffed the air. Then her ears straightened, and she whined. The hiss was almost imperceptible. A line of shadow leaped past Simon's face and struck one of the attenuated walkways with a sharp crack. Sparkling chips of green stone exploded in all directions. Simon whirled to look back. Standing not 100 ells away, separated from the companions only by the rolling expanse of river, stood a black garbed figure holding a bow as long as he was tall. A dozen or so others, garbed in blue and black surcoats, were scrambling up a pathway to stand beside him. One of them carried a torch. The black figure lifted a hand to his mouth, showing for an instant a flash of pale beard.
"You have nowhere to go,"
Ingen Jäger's voice came faint above the sound of the river.
"Surrender, in the king's name."
"The boat!"
Benevik cried. But even as they moved to the steps, black-clad Ingen reached out some slender thing toward the torchbearer. Fire blossomed at one end. A moment later, he had knocked it on his bowstring. As the companions reached the bottom step, a bolt of fire leaped across the river, exploding into the side of the boat. The quivering arrow ignited the bark almost instantly, and the troll had time only to pull one of the packs from the craft before the flames forced him back. Momentarily hidden behind the leaping fire, Simon and Maria darted up the stairs, Binnebik close behind. At the top, Kantaka was running from side to side, uttering hoarse barks of dismay.
"Run, now!"
Binnebik snapped. On the far side of the river, two more bowmen stepped up to Ingen's side. As Simon strained toward the cover of the nearest tower, he heard the awful hum of another arrow, and saw it skid across the tiles 20 cubits before him. Two more clattered against the tower wall that seemed so achingly far ahead. He heard a cry of pain, and Maria's terrified call.
Simon!
He whirled to see Binnabik tumble to the ground, a tiny bundle at the girl's feet. Somewhere, a wolf was howling. Chapter 28. Drums of Ice. The morning sun of the 24th day of May a month beamed down on her Nisadark, turning the golden disk atop the highest of the Taig's roofs into a circlet of brilliant flame. The sky was blue as an enamel plate, as though Brynjoch of the skies had chased the clouds away with his heavenly hazel stick, leaving them to lurk sullenly around the upper peaks of the looming Grianspog. The sudden return of spring should have gladdened Maegwin's heart. All over Hernestir, the untimely rains and cruel frosts had drawn a shroud over both the land and her father Luth's people. Flowers had frozen in the ground, unborn. Apples had dropped small and sour from the gnarled branches in the orchards. The sheep and cows put out to graze in sodden fields came back with rolling, frightened eyes, unnerved by hailstones and gusting winds. A blackbird, insolently waiting until the last moment, hopped up from Maegwin's path into the denuded branches of a cherry tree, where he trilled disputatiously. Maegwin paid him no heed, but hitched up her long dress and hurried toward her father's hall. She ignored the voice calling her name at first, unwilling to be hindered in her errand. Finally, reluctantly, she turned to see her half-brother Gwythyn running toward her. She stopped and waited for him, arms folded. Gwythyn's white tunic was disordered, and his golden neck torque had ridden halfway around to the back, as though he were a child instead of a young man of warrior age. He caught up and stood panting. She gave a snort of dismay and set to straightening out his garments. The prince smirked, but waited patiently while she pulled the torque around to lie against his collarbone. His long brown mane of hair had largely pulled free of the red cloth holding it in a careless horsetail. As she reached around to tie it, their faces were eye to eye. Although Gwythyn was by no means a short man, Maegwin scowled.
Begbus heard, Gwythyn, look at you. You must do better. You will be king some day.
And what has being king to do with how my hair is worn? Besides, I was handsome enough when I started out, but I had to run like the very wind to catch you, you with those long legs.
Maegwin flushed as she turned away. Her height was something about which, try as she might, she could not be matter of fact.
Well, you've caught me up now. Are you going to the hall?
I certainly am.
A sterner expression ran across Gwythyn's face like quicksilver, and he tugged at his long moustache.
I have things I must say to our father.
As do I,
Maegwin nodded, walking now. Their strides and heights so evenly matched, their sorrel-coloured hair so alike it might have been spun from one wheel. Any outsider would have guessed they were twins, instead of Maegwin 5 years older and from a different mother.
Our best brood sow, Egonwy, died evening last. Another one, Gwythyn. What is happening? Is it another plague, like at Abingit?
If it is a plague,
her brother said grimly, fingering the leather-wrapped hilt of his sword.
I know who brought it here. That man is a sickness on legs.
He slapped the pommel and spat.
I only pray that he speaks out of turn today. Brynjoch, would I love to cross blades with that one?
Maegwin narrowed her eyes.
Don't be a fool, she said crossly. Gathwulf has killed 100 men. And strange as it may seem, he is a guest at the Taig.
A guest who insults my father?
Gwythyn snarled, pulling his elbow from Maegwin's gentle, prisoning grasp.
A guest who brings threats from a high king drowning in his own poor kingship. A king who struts and bullies and spends golden coins like they were pebbles. Then turns to Hernestir and demands we help him.
Gwythyn's voice was rising, and his sister darted a glance around, worried who might hear. There was no one in sight but the pale shapes of the door guards 100 paces away. Where was King Elias when we lost the road to Narved and Elvritzhala? When bandits and the gods know what else descended on the Frost March Road? Face flushed again, the prince looked up to find Maegwin no longer at his side. He turned to see her standing, arms folded 10 steps behind.
Have you finished, Gwythyn?
She asked. He nodded, but his mouth was tight.
Good, then. The difference between our father and yourself, fellow, is more than only 30-some years. In those years he has learned when to speak and when to keep his thoughts inside. That is why, thanks to him, someday you stand to be King Gwythyn, and not just the Duke of Hernestia Duchy.
Gwythyn stared for a long moment.
I know, he said at last. You would have me be like Eole and bow and scrape to the dogs of Erkenland. I know you think Eole is the sun and moon, regarding not what he thinks of you, king's daughter though you be. But I am not such a man. We are Hernestiri. We crawl for no one.
Maegwin glared, stung by the jab over her feelings for the Count of Nad Mullach, about whom Gwythyn was exactly right. The attention he showed her was only that due to a king's gawky, unmarried daughter. But the tears she dreaded did not come. Instead, as she looked at Gwythyn, his handsome face twisted by frustration, by pride, and not least by genuine love of his people and land, she saw again the little brother she had once carried on her shoulder, and whom she herself had from time to time teased into tears.
Why are we fighting, Gwythyn? She asked wearily. What has brought this shadow down on our house?
Her brother lowered his gaze to his boot tops, embarrassed, then extended his hand.
Friends and allies, he said.
Come, let us go in and see father before the Earl of Utanit comes slinking in to bid fond farewells. The windows of the Taig's great hall were thrown open. The sunlight streaming through was full of sparkling dust from the rushes spread across the floor. The thick-walled timbers, hewed from the oak trees of the Kirkcoil, were fitted so carefully that not a gleam of light showed between them. Up among the roof beams hung 1,000 painted carvings of the gods of the Hernestiri, of heroes and monsters, all twisting slowly in the rafters, as reflected light shone warmly on their polished wooden features. At the hall's far end, sun splashing in on either side, King Luth Ublithin sat in his huge oaken chair. Beneath the carved stag's head that strained upward from the chair's back, antlers of real horn fixed to its wooden skull. The king was eating a bowl of porridge and honey with a bone spoon, while Inawen, his young wife, sat on a lower chair at his side, putting a tracery of delicate stitching onto the hem of one of Luth's robes. As the sentries banged their spear points twice upon their shields to signal Gwythyn's arrival, lesser nobility such as Count Eolair received only a single beat, while the king himself received 3, and Maegwin not a 1. Luth looked up and smiled, placing his bowl down on the arm of his chair and wiping his grey moustache on his sleeve. Inawen saw the gesture and gave Maegwin a despairing woman-to-woman look that Luth's daughter resented more than a little. Maegwin had never really gotten used to Gwythyn's mother, Fiathna, taking the place of her own. Maegwin's mother, Penemhwe, had died when Maegwin was 4. But at least Fiathna had been Luth's age, not a mere girl like Inawen. Still, this young golden-haired woman was good-hearted, although perhaps a little slow of wit. It was not really Inawen's fault she was a 3rd wife.
Gwythyn!
Luth half rose, brushing crumbs from the lap of his belted yellow robe.
Are we not lucky to have the sun today?
The king swept a hand windowward, as pleased as a child who has learned a trick.
It is a certain thing that we need a little, eh? And perhaps it will help to put our guests from Erkenland.
He made a wry face, his mobile clever features shifting into a look of bemusement, eyebrows arching above the thick, crooked nose broken in his boyhood,
to put them in a more agreeable mood, do you think?
No, I do not think that, Father, Gwythyn said, approaching as the king settled back into his antler-crested seat.
And I hope the answer you give them today, if I may presume, will send them away in an even fouler one.
He pulled up a stool and sat at the king's feet just below the raised platform, sending a harper scuttling.
One of Gothwulf's soldiers picked a fight with old Creovan last night. I had a hard time preventing Creovan from feathering the bastard's back with an arrow.
Luth looked troubled for a moment. Then the look was gone, hidden behind the smiling mask that Maegwin knew so well.
Ah, Father, she thought, even you are finding it a bit hard to keep the music playing while these creatures bay all around the take.
She walked quietly forward and sat on the platform by Gwythyn's stool.
Well, the king grinned ruefully. Sure it is that King Elias could have chosen his diplomats with a bit more care. But today, in an hour, they are gone. And peace descends again on her niece at Ark.
Luth snapped his fingers, and a serving boy sprang forward to take his dish of porridge away. And Arwen watched critically as it went by.
There, she said reproachfully. You didn't finish again. What am I to do with your father?
She added, this time directing her gaze to Maegwin, smiling fondly as though Maegwin, too, was a soldier in the constant battle to make Luth finish his meals. Maegwin, still at a loss as to how to deal with a mother a year younger than herself, hastily broke the silence.
Egonwy died, Father, our best, and the 10th sow this month, and some of the others have gotten very thin.
The king frowned.
This cursed weather! If Elias could but keep this spring sun overhead, I'd give him any tax he asked.
He reached down to pat Maegwin's arm, but was not quite able to reach.
All we can do is pile more rushes in the barns to keep out the chill. Failing that, we are in the godly hands of Brynjoch and Myrche.
There was another metallic clash of spear on shield, and the door speaker appeared, hands nervously clasped.
Your Highness, he called, the Earl of Utanyit requests an audience.
Luth smiled.
Our guests have decided to say farewell before they take to their horses. Of course, please, bring Earl Gothwulf in immediately.
But their guest, followed by several of his armored but unsworded men, was already moving past the ancient servant. Gothwulf dropped slowly to his knee 5 paces before the platform.
Your Majesty! Ah, and the prince as well. I am fortunate.
There was no hint of mockery in his voice, but his green eyes held an unsubtle fire.
And Princess Maegwin, a smile, the rose of her niece, said Ark.
Maegwin struggled to maintain her composure.
Sir, there was only one rose of her niece at Ark, she said, and since she was the mother of your King Elias, I am surprised it should slip your mind.
Gothwulf nodded gravely.
Of course, lady, I sought only to pay a compliment. But I must take exception to your calling Elias my king. Is he not yours too, under the high ward?
Gwythyn shifted on his stool, turning to see what his father's reaction would be. His scabbard scraped on the wooden platform.
Of course, of course.
Loth waved his hand slowly as if beneath deep water.
We have been through all this, and I see no need to belabor it. I recognize the debt of my house to King John. We have always honored it, in peace or war.
Yes,
the Earl of Utanyit stood, dusting the knees of his breeches. But what about your house's debt to King Elias? He has shown great tolerance. Then Arwen stood up, and the robe she had been sewing slid to the floor.
You must excuse me, she said breathlessly, plucking the garment up. There are things in the household I should attend to.
The king waved his permission, and she walked quickly but carefully between the waiting men and slid out the half-open door of the hall as lithely as a doe. Luth breathed a quiet sigh. Maegwin looked at him, seeing the always surprising lines of age that wreathed her father's face.
He is tired, and she, Inhawan, is frightened, Maegwin thought. I wonder what I am. Angry? I'm not sure. Exhausted, really.
As the king stared at Elias' messenger, the room seemed to darken. For a moment, Maegwin feared that clouds had covered the sun, that the winter was returning. Then she realized it was only her own apprehension, her sudden feeling that something more than her father's peace of mind hung in the balance here.
Gothwulf, the king began,
and his voice sounded bowed as though beneath a great weight.
Do not think to provoke me today, but neither think that you can cow me. The king has shown no tolerance for the troubles of the Ernestiri at all. We have weathered a bitter drought, and now the rains for which we thanked all the gods 1,000 times have themselves become a curse. What penalty that Elias can threaten me with can exceed that of seeing my people frightened or cattle starving? I can pay no greater tithe.
The Earl of Utanid stood silently for a moment, and the blankness of his expression slowly hardened into something that to Maegwin looked unsettlingly like jubilation.
No greater penalty,
the Earl said, savoring each word as though it felt good on his tongue.
No greater tithe?
He spat a wad of citral juice on the ground before the king's chair. Several of Luth's men-at-arms actually cried out in horror. The harper, who had been quietly playing in the corner, dropped his instrument with a discordant crash.
Dog!
Gwythyn leaped up, his stool clattering away. In a flashing moment his sword was out, and at Guthwulf's throat. The Earl only stared, his chin tipped ever so slightly back.
Gwythyn!
Luth barked.
Sheath, damn you, sheath!
Guthwulf's lip curled.
Let him. Go ahead, pup. Kill the High King's hand, unarmed.
There was a clanking by the door, as some of his men, their astonishment thawing, started to move forward. Guthwulf's hands shot up.
No! Even if this whelp should slip my weasand from ear to ear, no one shall strike back. You walk out and ride to Erkinland. King Elias will be most interested.
His men, confused, stood in place like armored scarecrows.
Let him go, Gwythyn,
Luth said, cold anger in his voice. The prince's face flushed, glared at the Erkinlander for a long moment, then dropped his blade back to his side. Guthwulf passed a finger over the tiny cut on his throat and gazed coolly at his own blood. Maegwin realized she had been holding her breath. At the sight of the crimson smear on the Earl's fingertip, she let it whistle out again.
You will live to tell Elias yourself, Utanit.
Only a slight tremor disturbed the evenness of the king's tone.
I hope you will tell him as well the mortal insult you have paid to the House of Herne, an insult that would have gained your death had you not been Elias' emissary and king's hand. Go!
Guthwulf turned and walked to where his men stood, wild-eyed. When he reached them, he pivoted on one heel, facing Luth across the expanse of the great hall.
Remember that you could think of no greater tithe you could pay, he said. If someday you hear fire in the beams of the Teig, and your children crying.
He strode heavily through the door. Maegwin, her hand shaking, bent and picked up a piece of the shattered harp and wound its curling string around her hand. She raised her head to look at her father and brother. What she saw there made her turn back again to the shard of wood in her palm, and the string pulled tight against her white skin. Breathing a soft Ranaman curse, Tiamak stared disconsolately at the empty cage of reeds. It was his third trap, and there had not been a crab yet. The fish head that had baited it was, of course, gone without trace. Glaring down into the muddy water, he had a sudden nervous premonition that the crabs were somehow a step ahead of him, were perhaps even now waiting for him to drop the cage down, larded with another pop-eyed head. He could picture a whole tribe of them scuttling over with expressions of glee, to poke the bait out through the bars with a stick or some other such tool recently granted to crab kind by some beneficent crustacean deity. Did the crabs worship him as a soft-shelled, providing angel, he wondered? Or did they look up at him with the cynical indifference of a gang of ne'er-do-wells, taking the measure of a drunkard before relieving him of his purse? He felt sure it was the latter. He rebaited the carefully woven cage and with a soft sigh let it splash down into the water, uncoiling its rope behind as it sank. The sun was just slipping below the horizon, washing the long sky above the marsh in shades of orange and persimmon red. As Tiamak pulled his flatboat through the Ran's waterways, distinguishable in places from the land only by the lesser height of the vegetation, he had a sinking feeling that today's ill luck was only the beginning of a long rising tide. He had broken his best bowl that morning, the one that he had spent 2 days writing Rohog the Potter's ancestor list to pay for. In the afternoon, he had shattered a pen nib and spattered a great gobbet of berry juice ink across his manuscript, ruining an almost completed page. And now, unless the crabs had decided to hold some kind of festival in the cramped confines of his last trap, there was going to be precious little to eat tonight. He was growing so very tired of root soup and rice biscuits. As he silently approached the last float, a latticework ball of reeds, he offered an unspoken prayer to he who always steps on sand, that even now the little bottom walkers were pushing and shoving their way into the cage below. Because of his unusual education, which included a year living on Perdruin, unheard of for a Ranaman, Tiamak did not really believe in he who steps on sand anymore. But he still felt a fondness for him, such as might be felt for a senile grandfather who often tumbled down from the house, but once brought nuts and carved toys. Besides, it never hurt to pray, even if one did not believe in the object of prayer. It helped to compose the mind, and at the very least, it impressed others. The trap came up slowly, and for a moment Tiamak's heart sped a little in his thin brown chest, as if seeking to drown out the expectant noises of his stomach. But the sensation of resistance was short-lived. Probably some clinging root which had held and then slipped away. And the cage suddenly popped up and bobbed on the water's cloudy surface. Something was moving inside. He lifted the cage up, interposing it between himself and the sunset glaring sky, squinting. Two tiny stalked eyes goggled back at him, eyes that wobbled atop a crab that would disappear in his palm if he folded his fingers over it. Tiamak snorted. He could imagine what had happened here. The older, rowdier crab brothers goaded the littlest into assaying the trap. The youngling caught inside, weeping while his crude brothers laughed and waved their claws. Then the giant shadow of Tiamak. The cage suddenly tugged upward, the crab brothers staring abashedly at each other, wondering how they would explain baby's absence to mother. Still, Tiamak thought, considering the hollowish feeling in his middle, if this was all he had to show for today, it was small, but it would go nicely in the soup. He squinted into the cage again, then upended it, shaking the prisoner out onto his palm. Why delude himself? This was a run on the sandbar day, and that was that. The crablet made a plopping noise as he dropped it back into the water. He did not even bother to re-sink the trap. As he climbed the long ladder from his moored boat to the little house perched in the banyan tree, Tiamak vowed to be content with soup and a biscuit. Gluttony was an obstacle, he reminded himself, an impediment between the soul and the realms of truth. As he reeled the ladder up onto the porch, he thought of she who birthed mankind, who had not even had a nice bowl of root soup, but had subsisted entirely on rocks and dirt and swamp water, until they combined in her stomach, and she whelped a litter of clay men, the first humans. There, that made root soup a real bargain, didn't it? Besides, he had much work to do anyway. Repair or rewrite the blotched manuscript page, for one thing. Among his tribesmen, he was thought of as merely strange, but somewhere out in the world there would be people who would read his revision of Sovereign Remedies of the Rana Healers and realize that there were mines of true learning in the marshes. But I, a crab, would have gone down smartly. That, and a jug of fern beer. As Tiamak washed his hands in the water bowl he had put out before leaving, crouching because there was no room to sit between his obsessively scraped and polished writing board and his water jug, he heard a scratching sound on the roof. He listened carefully as he wiped his hands dry on his waistcloth. It came again, a dry rustle, like his broken pen being rubbed across the thatching. It took him only a moment to slide out the window and climb hand over hand onto the sloping roof. Grasping one of the banyan's long, curving limbs, he made his way up to where a little bark-roofed box sat atop the roof peak, an infant house carried on its mother's back. He ducked his head into the box's open end. It was there, right enough, a grey sparrow, pecking briskly at the seeds that were scattered across the floor. Tiamak reached in a gentle hand to enfold it. Then, as carefully as he could, he climbed down the roof and slid in through the window. He put the sparrow in the crab cage he kept hanging from the roof beam for just such occasions, and quickly made a fire. When the flames began to lick up from the stone hearth, he removed the bird from the cage, his eyes smarting as the smoke began to coil toward the hole in the ceiling. The sparrow had lost a feather or two from its tail, and held one wing out a bit from its side as though it had come through some scrapes on its way down from Erkenland. He knew it had come from Erkenland, because it was the only sparrow he had ever raised. His other birds were marsh doves, but Morgainis insisted on sparrows for some reason. Funny old man he was. After he had set a pot of water on the flames, Tiamak did what he could for the awkward silver wing, then put down more seeds and a hollow curl of bark full of water. He was tempted to wait until he had eaten to read the message, to hold off the pleasure of faraway news as long as possible. But on a day like this one had been, such patience was too much to expect of himself. He mashed some rice flour up in the mortar, added some pepper and water, then spread the mixture out and rolled it into a cake, which he set on the firestone to bake. The slip of parchment that had been wrapped around the sparrow's leg was ragged at the edges, and the printed characters were smeared, as though the bird had gotten more than a little wet. But he was used to such things and soon sorted it out. The notation signifying the date when it had been written surprised him. The grey sparrow had taken nearly a month to reach the Ran. The message surprised him even more, but it was not the kind of surprise he had been hoping for. It was with a feeling of cold weight in his stomach superseding any hunger that he went to the window, looking out past the tangled banyan branches to the fast-blooming stars. He stared into the northern sky, and for a moment could almost believe he felt a cold wind knifing in, driving a wedge of chill through the warm air of the Ran. It was a long time at the window before he noticed the smell of his supper burning. Count Eolaire sat back in the deep cushioned chair and looked up at the high ceiling. It was covered in religious paintings, painstaking renditions of Usiri's Healing the Washerwoman, Sutrin martyred in the arena of the Imperator Crexus, and other such subjects. The colors seemed to be fading somewhat, and many of the pictures were obscured by dust, as though draped in a fine veil. Still, it was an impressive sight, for all that this was one of the smaller antechambers of the Sankelin Adonitis. A million weight of sandstone, marble, and gold, Eolaire thought, and all for a monument to something no one has ever seen. Unbidden, a wave of homesickness washed over him, as had often happened in this last week. What he would not give to be back in his humble hall in Nad Mullach, surrounded by nieces and nephews and the small monuments of his own people and gods, or at the Teig in her niece Sadak, where a bit of his secret heart always lingered, instead of surrounded here by the land-devouring stone of Naban. But the scent of war was on the wind, and he could not lock himself away when his king had asked his help. Still, he was weary of travelling, The grass of Hernesteer would feel fine beneath his horse's hooves again.
Count Erler, forgive me, please, for keeping you waiting.
Father Denevan, the lector's young secretary, stood in the far doorway wiping his hands on his black robe.
Today has been a full one already, and we have not reached the forenoon. Still, he laughed, that is a terribly poor excuse. Please, come into my chambers.
Eilef followed him out of the antechamber, his boots silent on the old, thick carpets.
There, said Denevan, grinning and warming his hands before the fire. Is that better? It is a scandal, but we cannot keep the Lord's greatest house warm. The ceilings are too high, and it has been such a cold spring.
The Count smiled.
Truth to tell, I had not much noticed it. In Hernesteer, we sleep with our windows open, except in direst winter. We are a people who live out of doors.
Denevan wagged his eyebrows. And we, Nabene, are soft southerners, eh?
I did not say that, Ayla laughed. One thing you southerners are, you are masters of clever speech.
Denevan sat down in a hard-backed chair.
Ah, but his sacredness the lector, who is an Erkinlandish man originally, as you well know. The lector can talk circles around any of us. He is a wise and subtle man.
That I know. And it is about him I would speak, Father.
Call me Denevan, please. Ah, it is ever the fate of a great man's secretary, to be sought out for one's proximity rather than one's personality.
He made a mock, downcast face. Eilef again found himself liking this priest very much.
Such indeed is your doom, Denevan. Now hear, please. I suppose you know why my master has sent me here.
I would have to be a clod indeed not to know. These are times that set tongues wagging like the tails of excited dogs. Your master reaches out to Leobardis, that they can make some sort of common cause.
Indeed.
Ayla stepped away from the fire to draw up a chair near Denevan's.
We are delicately balanced, my Luth, your lector and Asin, Elias the High King, Duke Leobardis.
And Prince Joshua, if he lives,
Denevan said,
and his face was worried. Yes, a delicate balance. And you know that the lector can do nothing to upset that balance.
Ayla nodded slowly. I know.
So why have you come to me?
Denevan asked kindly.
I am not quite sure. Only this I would tell you. It seems there is some struggle brewing, as often happens, but I myself fear it is deeper. You might think me a madman, but I foretold that an age is ending, and I fear what the coming one may bring.
The lector's secretary stared. For a moment his plain face seemed far older, as though he reflected on sorrows long carried.
I will say only that I share your fears, Count Eolair, he said at last. But I cannot speak for the lector except to say, as I did before, he is a wise and subtle man.
He stroked the tree at his breast.
For your heart's ease, though, I can say this. Duke Leobardis has not yet made up his mind where he will lend his support. Although the High King alternately flatters and threatens him, still Leobardis resists.
Well, this is good news, said Ayala, and smiled warily. When I saw the Duke this morning, he was very distant, as though he feared to be seen listening to me too closely.
He has many things to weigh, as does my own master,
Denevan replied.
But know this too, and it is a deep secret. Just this morning, I took Baron de Vercellis in to see Lector and Essen. The Baron is about to set forth on an embassy that will mean much to both Leobardis and my master, and will have much to do with which way Naban throws her might in any conflict. I can tell you no more than that, but I hope it is something.
It is more than a little, ALS said.
I thank you for your trust, Denivan.
Somewhere in the Sankalanada Nitis, a bell rang, deep and low.
The clavian bell calls out the noon hour, Father Denivan said. Come, let us find us something to eat and a jug of beer, and talk about more pleasant things.
A smile chased across his features, making him young again.
Did you know I traveled once to Hernistir? Your country is beautiful, Eolair.
Although somewhat lacking in stone buildings, the Count replied, patting the wall of Denivan's chamber.
And that is one of its beauties,
the priest laughed, leading him out the door. The old man's beard was white, and long enough that he tucked it into his belt when he walked, which until this morning he had been doing for several days. His hair was no darker than his beard. Even his hooded jacket and leggings were made from the thick pelt of a white wolf. The creature's skin had been carefully flayed, the forelegs crossed on his chest, and its jawless head, nailed to a cap of iron, sat upon his own brow. Had it not been for the bits of red crystal in the wolf's empty sockets, and the old man's fierce blue eyes beneath, he would have been nothing but another patch of white in the snow-covered forest that lay between Drosol Lake and the hills. The moaning of the wind in the treetops increased, and a spatter of snow dropped from the branches of the tall pine tree onto the man crouching below. He shook himself impatiently, like an animal, and a fine mist rose around him, momentarily breaking the weak sunlight into a fog of tiny rainbows. The wind continued its keening song, and the old man in white reached to his side, grasping something that at first appeared to be only another lump of white, a snow-covered stone or tree stump. He held it up, brushing the powdery whiteness from its top and sides, then lifted away the cloth just far enough to peer inside. He whispered into the opening and waited, then knitted his brows for an instant as if annoyed or troubled. Setting the object down, he stood up and unbuckled the belt of bleached reindeer hide from around his waist. After first pulling the hood back from his lean, weather-hardened face, he stripped off the wolfskin coat. The sleeveless shirt he wore beneath was the same color as the jacket, the skin of his sinewy arms not much darker. But starting on his right wrist, just above the fur gauntlet, the head of a snake was drawn in bright inks, scribed in blue and black and blood-red, directly on the skin. The body of the snake curved round and round the old man's right arm in a spiral, disappearing into the shoulder of his shirt to reappear writhing sinuously about his left arm and terminate in a curlicued tail at the wrist. This fierce splash of color leaped out against the dull winter forest and the man's white garb and skin. From a short distance it appeared that some flying serpent, halved in mid-air, was suffering its death agonies 2 cubits above the frozen earth. The old man paid no attention to the goose flesh on his arms until he had finished draping his jacket over the bundle, tucking the loose folds in beneath it. Then he pulled a leather bag from a pouch in his undershirt, squeezed from it a quantity of yellow grease, and briskly rubbed it over his exposed skin, causing the serpent to gleam as though newly arrived from some humid southern jungle. The task over, he crouched back again on his heels to wait. He was hungry, but he had finished the last of his traveling rations the night before. That was of no importance anyway, because soon the ones he waited for would come. And then there would be food. Chin tilted down, cobalt eyes smoldering beneath his icy brows, Yarnalgo watched the southern approaches. He was an old, old man, and the rigors of time and weather had made him hard and spare. In a way, he looked forward to the hour that was coming soon, when death called for him and took him to her dark, quiet hall. Silence and solitude held no terror. They had been the warp and weft of his long life. He wanted only to finish the task that had been set before him, to hand on a torch that others might use in the darkness ahead. Then he would let life and body go as easily as he shrugged the snow from his bare shoulders. Thinking of the solemn halls that waited at the final turn of his road, he remembered his beloved Tungoldir, left behind him a fortnight ago. As he had stood upon his doorstep that last day, the little town where he had spent most of his 4½ score of years had stretched before him, as empty as the legendary Hulheim that awaited him when his work was done. Only Yarnauga remained in the village called Moon Door, perched among the high Himmelfell mountains, but still in the shadow of distant Sturmaspik, the storm spike. The winter had hardened into a cold that even the Rimmersmen of Tungoldir had never known before, and the nighttime songs of the winds had changed into something that had the sound of howling and weeping in it, until men went mad and were found laughing in the morning, their families dead around them. Only Yarnauga had remained in his small house, as the ice mists became thick as wool in the mountain passes and the narrow streets of the town, Tungoldir's sloping roofs seeming to float like the ships of ghost warriors sailing the clouds. No one but Yarnauga had been around to see the flickering lights of Stormspike burn brighter and brighter, to hear the sounds of vast, harsh music that wound in and out through the din of thunder, playing across the mountains and valleys of this northernmost province of Rimmersgard. But now even he, his time come around at last, as made known to him by certain signs and messages, had left Tungoldir to the creeping darkness and cold. Yarnauga knew that no matter what happened, he would never again see the sun on the wooden houses, or listen to the singing of the mountain rills as they splashed past his front door, down to the swelling Gratuvask. Neither would he stand on his porch in the clear, dark spring nights and see the lights in the sky, the shimmering northern lights that had been there since his boyhood. Not the guttering, sickly flares now playing about the dark face of Stormspike. Such things were gone now. His road ahead was plain, but there was little joy in it. But not everything was clear, even now. There was still the nagging dream to be dealt with, the dream of the Black Book and the Three Swords. It had dogged his sleep for a fortnight, but its meaning was still hidden from him. His thoughts were interrupted by a blotch of movement on the southern approach, far away along the rim of the trees dotting the Weald Helm's western skirts. He squinted briefly, then slowly nodded his head and rose to his feet. As he was pulling his coat back on, the wind changed direction. A moment later, a dim mutter of thunder rolled down from the north. It came again, a low growl, like a beast struggling awake from sleep. On its heels, but from the opposite direction, the sound of hooves grew from a murmur to a noise that rivaled the thunder. As Yarnauga picked up his cage of birds and walked out to meet the riders, the sounds grew together. Thunder tolling in the north, the muffled din of approaching horsemen to the south, until they filled the white forest with their cold rumble, like music made on drums of ice. Chapter 29. Hunters and Hunted. The hollow roar of the river filled his ears. For a heartbeat, it seemed to Simon that the water was the only moving thing. That the archers on the far side, Maria, he himself, all had been frozen into immobility by the impact of the arrow that quivered in Binnebik's back. Then another shaft spat past the white-faced girl, splintering noisily against a broken cornice of shining stone, and all was frantic movement once more. Only half aware of the insect-like scuttling of the archers across the water, Simon covered the distance back to the girl and troll in 3 steps. He bent to look, a strange, isolated part of his mind noticing how the boy's leggings Maria wore had tattered holes at the knee, and an arrow snicked through his shirt beneath his arm. At first he thought it had missed him completely. A moment later he felt a flare of pain sizzle along his ribcage. More darts skimmed past, hitting low on the tiles before them and skipping like stones on a lake. Simon quickly kneeled and scooped the silent troll into his arms, feeling the horrible, stiff arrow quiver between his fingers. He turned, putting his back between the little man and the archers. Benevik was so pale. He was dead, he must be. Then stood. The pain in his ribs burned him again, and he staggered, Maria catching at his elbow.
Lucan's blood, screamed the black-garbed Ingen,
his far-off voice a faint murmur in Simon's ear.
You're killing them, you idiots. I said to keep them there. Where is Baron Herefoth?
Kentucker had run down to join them. Maria tried to wave the wolf away as she and Simon lumbered up the stairs into Dai Chikisa. One last feathered shaft cracked into the step behind them. Then the air was still again.
Herefoth is here, Rimmersman,
a voice shouted amid the clamor of armored men. Simon looked back from the top step. His heart sank. A dozen men in battle array were rushing past Ingen and his bowmen, heading straight for the Gate of Stags, the bridge Simon and his companions had passed beneath just before coming ashore. The Baron himself rode behind them on his red horse, a long spear held above his head. They couldn't have outrun even the foot soldiers for long. The Baron's horse would catch them in three breaths.
Simon, run!
Maria jerked his arm, pulling him forward at a stumble.
We must hide in the city!
But Simon knew that was hopeless too. By the time they reached the first concealment, the soldiers would be upon them.
Herefoth!
Ingen Jegger's voice cried out behind them, a flat, small sound above the river's drone.
You can't! Don't be a fool, Erkinlander! Your horse!
The rest was lost in water sounds. If Herefoth heard, he did not seem to care. In a moment, the clangor of his soldiers' feet upon the bridge was matched by the pounding of hoofbeats on stone. Even as the din of pursuit mounted, Simon caught the toe of his boot on an uprooted tile and pitched forward.
A spear in the back,
he thought to himself in mid-fall, and how did all this happen? Then he was tumbling painfully onto his shoulder, rolling to protect the cradled body of the troll. He lay on his back, staring up at the patches of sky gleaming through the dark dome of trees, Benevik's not unsubstantial weight perched on his chest. Maria was pulling at his shirt, trying to get him upright. He wanted to tell her it was not important now, no longer worth the bother. But as he sat up on one elbow, propping the troll's body with his other arm, he saw a strange thing happening below. In the middle of the long, arching bridge, Baron Herefoth and his men had stopped moving. No, that was not quite correct. They were swaying in place. The men-at-arms clinging to the bridge's low walls. The Baron perched atop his horse, his features not quite distinguishable from this distance, but his pose that of a man who is startled out of sleep. A moment later, for no reason Simon could discern, the horse reared and plunged forward. The men followed, running faster than before. Immediately after, a flicker behind the movement, Simon heard a great crack, as though a giant hand had snapped off a tree trunk for a toothpick. The bridge seemed to come unstuck in the middle. Before the shocked, fascinated eyes of Simon and Maria, the slender Gate of Stags plunged downward, middle first, stones crumbling loose in great, angular shards to crash foaming into the water below. For a few pulse beats, it seemed that Herefoth and his soldiers would reach the far side. Then, rippling like a shook-out blanket, the arc of stone folded in on itself, sending a writhing mass of arms, legs, pale faces, and a thrashing horse toppling down amidst the ragged blocks of milky chalcedony to disappear in gouts of green water and white froth. A few moments later, the head of the Baron's horse appeared several ells downstream, neck straining upward, then it slid back into the swirling river. Simon slowly tilted his head around to the base of the bridge. The two archers were on their knees, staring into the torrent. The black-hooded figure of Ingen stood behind them, staring across at the companions. It felt like his pale eyes were only inches away.
Get up!
Maria shouted, pulling at Simon's hair. He freed his gaze from Ingen Jegger's with an almost palpable snap of separation, like a cord fraying through. He climbed to his feet, balancing his small burden, and they turned and fled into the echoes and tall shadows of Dai Chikisa. Simon's arms were aching after 100 steps, and it felt as though a knife was sliding in and out of his side. He fought to stay even with the girl as they followed the bounding wolf through the ruins of the Scythi city. It was like running through a cave of trees and icicles, a forest of vertical shimmer and dark, mossy corruption. Shattered tile was everywhere, and massive tangles of spiderweb strung across beautiful crumbling arches. Simon felt as though he had been swallowed by some incredible ogre with innards of quartz and jade and mother of pearl. The river sounds became muted behind them. The rasp of their own hard breathing vied with the scrape of their running feet. At last, it seemed that they were reaching the outskirts of the city. The tall trees, hemlock and cedar, and towering pine were closer together, and the tiled flooring that had been everywhere underfoot now dwindled to pathways, coiling at the feet of the forest giants. Simon stopped running. His eyesight was blackening at the edges. He stood in place and felt the earth reel about him. Maria took his hand and led him a few limping steps to an ivy-choked mound of stone that Simon, his sight slowly returning, recognized as a well. He set Binnebik's body down gently on the pack that Maria had been carrying, propping the little man's side against the rough cloth, then leaned on the well's rim to suck air into his needy lungs. His side continued to throb. Maria squatted next to Binnebik, pushing away Kantaka's nose as the wolf prodded at her silent master. Kantaka took a step back, making a whimpering sound of incomprehension, then lay down with her muzzle on her paws. Simon felt hot tears spring to his eyes.
"He's not dead," Simon stared at Maria, then at Binnebik's colorless face. "What?" he asked. "What do you mean?" "He's not dead," she repeated without looking up.
Simon kneeled beside her. She was right. The troll's chest was moving almost imperceptibly. A frothy bubble of blood on his lower lip pulsed in time.
"Osiris Aiden,"
Simon wiped.